Today is Wednesday, September 2nd, and this is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump's response to protests and violence draws criticism from Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden.
Fires are burning and we have a president who fans the flames rather than fighting the flames.
Also ahead, India's COVID-19 infections rose to almost 3.8 million cases. Plus, Pope Francis holds a public audience for the first time in 6 months. These stories and more are next. Our top story today. Ignoring local officials' concerns over racial tensions, President Donald Trump visited Kenosha, Wisconsin, the site of violent protests triggered by the shooting of a black man by a white police officer last month. Trump has been pushing his campaign message of law and order. VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wittakaswara has the story.
Protests and counter-protests greeted President Donald Trump's visit to Kenosha, Wisconsin, following violent unrest over the police shooting of Jacob Blake on August 23rd. The black man was shot 7 times in the back by a white police officer trying to arrest him. Defying statements from the Kenosha mayor and Wisconsin governor, who say the president's visit will trigger more racial tension, Trump toured a business area burnt down during the unrest.
And we're going to help them a lot. I think we're going to help them a lot.
Trump met with law enforcement, but not the Blake family. He pushed a message of law and order to tamp down months of sometimes violent protests around the country, wading deeper into the debate over racial tension ahead of the November election. This week, Trump suggested that a white teenager accused of fatally shooting 2 people with a semi-automatic weapon during the Kenosha unrest may have acted in self-defense, prompting more criticism, including from Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden.
Fires are burning and we have a president who fans the flames rather than fighting the flames. But we must not burn. We have to build.
Trump blamed Democrats for enabling the violence, which he called domestic terror.
Reckless far-left politicians continue to push the destructive message that our nation and our law enforcement are oppressive or racist.
The president's response to racial unrest is becoming a key election issue, with some research suggesting it may motivate black voters to come to the polls. But despite the Trump campaign's laser focus on law and order, ultimately it may not change many minds. Omar Wasso is a professor of political science at Princeton University, focusing on race and politics.
Support, particularly among whites, for the protest movement has declined somewhat. But in a highly polarized country, Trump's base of support is stable, Biden's base of support is stable, and we're just not seeing that much movement despite news events.
Still, the Trump campaign is making an appeal to white suburban voters concerned by the violence, particularly in swing states such as Wisconsin. Patsy Wittakaswara, VOA News.
There are new questions about the president's health. AP's Sagar Magani has more.
A new book is reviving questions about President Trump's unscheduled visit to Walter Reed Military Hospital last fall. The White House billed the November visit as part of the president's routine annual physical, but those are typically announced ahead of time, and this was not. In his new book, New York Times reporter Michael Schmidt writes, in the hours before the visit, word went out for Vice President Pence to be on standby to take over the powers of the presidency if President Trump had to receive anesthesia for a medical problem. Pence tells Fox News Channel he's always on standby, but does not recall being told to be ready before the hospital visit. The president had his doctor release a statement yesterday declaring him fit to serve and denying the president's ever been treated for a stroke or any acute cardiovascular emergency. Sagar Magani, Washington.
In Geneva, the UN Development Program warns the explosion at the port of Beirut last month has unleashed tons of hazardous waste that pose enormous threats to health and the environment if not disposed of properly. UN officials say huge quantities of construction and demolition waste were generated when over 2,000 tons of ammonium nitrate stored at the port exploded in early August. Lisa Schlein reports.
Jihan Saoud is program manager of UNDP's Environment and Energy Program in Lebanon. She says the amount of toxic waste discharged by the blast is estimated between 100,000 and 800,000 tons. She says the likely impact of hazardous waste from chemical contamination produced by materials such as pesticides, pharmaceuticals, industrial chemicals, lead, and heavy metals is of great concern.
These chemicals can negatively affect, have a negative effect on health of people that are exposed to them, and can also contaminate the soil and water. Initial reported air pollution from the blast is now considered to be limited. However, chemical contamination of particles that were scattered by the explosion may become airborne again and could pose a public health risk.
Sayed warns marine life also could be contaminated by seeping chemicals if the waste in the port is not contained and treated properly. She says the safe disposal of the toxic waste is a big problem because Lebanon has limited land available for landfilling. She says the country also has no hazardous waste storage or treatment facility. To make things worse, the UN official says the blast severely damaged one of the two municipal waste facilities in Beirut. She adds the facility that remains is unable to handle the amount of waste being generated.
It's filling up faster, and we already have a potential crisis because of that, because the landfill is reaching its capacity. So this was a pre-existing situation in the country that has only worsened and been compounded by the blast. This is also why the debris and the waste from the blast should not go to the municipal landfills, because there isn't enough room and capacity there. They should be treated separately.
Sayoud says the UN and the European Union are working together to ensure that debris removal and waste management is done properly and in an environmentally sound manner. She says the cost of this operation is estimated at more than $100 million. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. officials say Washington would like to see more Arab and Muslim countries follow the United Arab Emirates' lead in normalizing relations with Israel. It looks to Oman, Bahrain, and Sudan as possible candidates. But Israel's peace partner and staunch Palestinian supporter, Jordan, worries that the Israel-UAE deal will scuttle the two-state solution, and it could possibly be one of the biggest losers if the land for peace option is abandoned. Dale Govlock reports from Oman.
Jordanian analyst Osama Al-Sharif, writing on the Al Monitor website, says Jordan's long-standing political approach to resolving the Palestinian-Israeli conflict could become a minority position. Regional heavyweight Saudi Arabia stands with Jordan and upholds the 2002 Arab Peace Initiative put forward to Israel. It calls for normalized ties in exchange for Israel's full withdrawal from occupied lands, a just settlement for Palestinian refugees, and a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital. Al-Sharif and analyst Labib Kamhawi warn that peace deals without the Palestinians won't resolve the 72-year-old conflict.
This doesn't come out of conviction in the importance of peace that is based on justice. It will end up very marginal and symbolic normalization, like the way the Egyptian and the Jordanian people feel about the Israelis and Israel. It will simply put a crisis on hold, and it will not eliminate it.
The UAE says it still wants a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital. Gulf Arab nations have increased commercial relations with Israel in recent years and share concerns over Iran. U.S. officials say Washington would like to see more Gulf nations normalize relations with Israel. We don't need to make the sales pitch. Everyone sees the benefits, a senior State Department official said during Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's recent visit to Bahrain. Jordan's foreign minister, Ayman al-Safadi, said the UAE-Israel peace deal should prod Israel to accept a Palestinian state. He warned if this didn't happen, it would only deepen the decades-long Arab-Israeli conflict and threaten the security of the region as a whole. A key U.S. regional ally, Jordan hosts the largest number of Palestinian refugees, numbering 2 million.
Jordan has a lot at stake, and it stands to lose much of its internal security and peace of mind because the majority of Jordanians are of Palestinian origin. And these look at the sanctity of the Palestine issue, something that should be adhered to and respected by all.
Still, Jordanian analyst Amr Sabele says Jordan's 1994 peace treaty with Israel benefits both sides, especially in the security area, and neither side will risk damaging bilateral ties. Jordan's former foreign minister Marwan Moasher said even if other Gulf states follow the UAE's lead, the root issue remains. In the end, it's not the Gulf states who are living under occupation. It's the Palestinians. And until you reach a solution with the Palestinians, it does not matter how many peace deals you make with Arab states, he told Reuters. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
Saudi Arabia announced Wednesday that flights to and from the United Arab Emirates, quote, from all countries, end quote, will now be able to use its airspace, a statement apparently allowing flyovers by Israel following the deal to normalize UAE-Israel relations. You're listening to VOA. The trial began Wednesday for 13 men and a woman charged in the 2015 attacks against the Charlie Hebdo satirical newspaper and a kosher supermarket in Paris. The attack began 3 days of violence by the Islamic State group in Europe from January 7th to the 9th. 17 people and three gunmen died during the attacks. The defendants in France's terrorism court are accused of buying weapons and cars and helping with logistics. Most of them have said they thought they were helping plan an ordinary crime. Three are being tried in absentia after leaving France to join Islamic State. The attacks started at Charlie Hebdo's offices and apparently were in retaliation for the publication of caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad years before. Brothers Sharif and Said Kouchi attacked the office, killing 12 people before fleeing in a stolen vehicle. They claimed the attacks in the name of Al-Qaeda. The chief jailer of Cambodia's Khmer Rouge government, who admitted overseeing the killings of thousands of Cambodians while running the country's most notorious prison, has died. Kang Guek Eve, known as Comrade Dutch, was 77. He was serving a life prison term for war crimes and crimes against humanity after becoming the first senior Khmer Rouge figure to be tried by a UN-backed tribunal. From 1975 to 1979, the Marxist Khmer Rouge governed Cambodia and is blamed for the deaths of 1.7 million people, a quarter of the population at the time. The leader of a prominent Sudanese rebel group rejected a peace deal signed Monday by the country's government and a rebel coalition. Abdul Wahid Nur of the Sudan Liberation Movement told VOA's South Sudan in Focus program that the deal is merely a plan to distribute wealth and government positions and does not address the roots of Sudan's conflicts. Another rebel faction, the Sudan People's Liberation Army North, led by General Abdulaziz Al-Hilu, did not take part in the agreement. Both rebel groups want Sudan to be a secular state. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. India's COVID-19 infections rose to almost 3.8 million on Wednesday as states continued to relax rules on movement despite a surge in cases. Reuters' Olivia Chan reports.
The number of known coronavirus cases in India has risen to almost 3.8 million, on course to replace Brazil as the second highest in the world, even as the Asian country continues to relax its quarantine measures. In the southern city of Bengaluru, for example, thousands of pubs were set to serve alcohol starting from Tuesday, after a six-month gap. Elsewhere, Goa, a popular tourist destination, has recently relaxed quarantine rules to attract visitors. And authorities in the capital, New Delhi, are also due to meet on Wednesday to discuss the reopening of the city's metro, despite fresh cases there sitting at a two-month high. But like many other countries, India's economy has been hit hard by the virus. Its economy shrank by nearly a quarter in April to June, much more than forecast. Prime Minister Narendra Modi ordered a nationwide lockdown in March when the country was reporting less than 100 daily cases. Experts have praised Modi's early actions, but others have said the restrictions had been imposed too soon. If the country surpasses Brazil in cases, it will still lag far behind the number one spot, the United States.
Olivia Chan of Reuters had that report. Australian officials say the nation has officially fallen into a recession for the first time since the early 1990s. Lockdowns and other restrictions imposed to contain the spread of COVID-19 have affected most parts of the economy, and hundreds of thousands of jobs have been lost. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australia's treasurer calls it a crisis like no other, the country's worst downturn in decades. Data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics has shown that gross domestic product, or GDP, has fallen by 7% in the second quarter this year. It was worse than many economists had predicted. The coronavirus pandemic has adversely affected almost every sector, from retail and hospitality to mining, education and tourism. The result is Australia's first official recession in almost 30 years. Officials say there could be more pain to come. A second wave of infections in the state of Victoria, where strict lockdown measures have been reimposed, is likely to delay a recovery. Matthias Cormann is the Australian Finance Minister.
If you look at what's happening towards the end of June and early July, we were certainly heading in the right direction. Jobs were being restored across the economy and indeed across many sectors of the economy. Activity was picking up. But then, of course, the outbreak in Victoria happened. So what we desperately need is to continue to get on top of the outbreak in Victoria to open up the economy as much as we can, as soon as we can.
Australia survived the Asian financial crisis in the late 1990s and the global credit crunch a decade later. A long mining boom, sound financial management and good fortune all helped. But the Australian economy was faltering before the coronavirus took hold, partly because of drought and bushfires. Opposition lawmakers say it's a dark day in Australia's history. Unemployment is rising. The official jobless rate is 7.5%. The government has extended a multi-billion dollar wage subsidy until March 2021. Two consecutive contractions in GDP is the official indicator of a technical recession. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Pope Francis held his first weekly general audience in public in 6 months on Wednesday and announced an International Day of Prayer and Fasting for Lebanon.
Cari fratelli e sorelle, buongiorno.
About 500 people attended the audience held in the San Damaso courtyard of the Vatican. Nearly all wore masks and kept social distance in arranged seats, but many broke ranks when the Pope walked near them.
Dopo tanti mesi, riprendiamo il nostro incontro faccia a faccia.
He says, after so many months, we resume our encounters face to face and not screen to screen. Face to face, and this is beautiful. Francis appeared to enjoy himself as he walked past the people, stopping often to converse with individuals from a distance of 1 or 2 meters. The Pope last held an audience with a public crowd in early March. After that, he held virtual audiences transmitted from the official papal library over television or the internet.
L'attuale pandemia ha evidenziato la nostra interdependenza.
He says the current pandemic has highlighted our interdependence. We are all linked to each other, for better or for worse. Therefore, to come out of this crisis better than before, we have to do so together, together, not alone, together. Either we do it together or we can't. We have to do it all together in solidarity. Francis met a Lebanese priest and bowed his head to say a silent prayer for the country, which is still reeling from last month's deadly port blast and rising sectarian tensions. The two men held up a Lebanese flag.
Di fronte ai ripetuti drammi.
He says, after the repeated tragedies that the people of Lebanon know, we become aware of the extreme danger that threatens the very existence of the country. Lebanon cannot be abandoned to itself. I ask politicians, religious leaders, and the international community to commit themselves with sincerity and transparency to reconstruct the country, leaving aside personal interests and looking at the common good and the future of the nation. The Pope announced that this Friday would be a day of prayer and fasting for Lebanon, and that he was sending his Secretary of State, Cardinal Pietro Parolin, to Beirut on that day to represent him. Refugees seeking new lives in Europe by crossing the eastern Mediterranean to Greece say they are increasingly subject to being robbed, beaten, or even abandoned at sea. More from VOA's Heather Murdoch in Istanbul.
Since February, VOA has talked to scores of refugees in Turkey who say they have tried but failed to get into Greece. Back then, the Turkish government was openly encouraging them to make the trip, but the Greek government told them not to come. And many refugees reported being beaten, robbed, and then expelled after they arrived. In recent months, the stories have become even more harrowing. Families tell of Greek authorities leaving them at sea on rubber boats without motors or fuel. This is Najma, a 50-year-old single mother with two sons. She and her family were on their third attempt to reach Greece when their boat was stopped and their fuel was seized by what appeared to be Greek security forces. But they were lucky. They say a passenger had enough fuel hidden away to get them back to Turkey. 12-year-old Ibrahim, Najma's son, says at first he wasn't scared. But then, he says, officers began poking the rubber boat with sharp pikes, and people started screaming, afraid the officers would pop the boat. On a previous trip, the refugees said they made it to the Greek islands, but they said they were soon arrested and left on rafts at sea before the Turkish Coast Guard rescued them. Greece has denied any illegal activity, noting that it has rescued tens of thousands of asylum seekers in recent years. The government adds it protects European Union borders vigorously with tough but fair policies. The New York Times recently reported Greece has secretly expelled more than 1,000 people in recent months, abandoning many of them at sea outside of Greek territorial waters. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Istanbul.
That's it for our show today. Thank you for listening to The Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
September 2nd marks the official end of the Second World War in the Pacific, and therefore the end of the global conflict. On that day, 75 years ago, formal documents of Japan's unconditional surrender were signed by representatives of the United States and Japan aboard the ship USS Missouri as it lay anchored in Tokyo Bay. With Germany's surrender on May 8th, World War II had come to an end in Europe. Nonetheless, fighting raged on in the Pacific, and the war would not be over until Japan laid down its arms. On July 26, 10 days after the United States successfully tested the atomic bomb, Allied leaders issued the Potsdam Declaration, a document which outlined the terms of surrender for the Empire of Japan. If Japan refused the offer, it would suffer prompt and utter destruction. Japan declined the ultimatum. It therefore became necessary to defeat Japan on the battlefield, clearly a formidable task. For over 3 years, the United States and its allies in the Pacific clashed with Japan in some of the largest naval battles in history. Fierce battles across the Pacific Islands, which more often than not resulted in mass suicides by defeated Japanese soldiers and civilians alike, convinced the United States command that an invasion of Japan would result in enormous loss of life on both sides. It was therefore decided that the war must be ended swiftly and decisively. After dropping leaflets warning of imminent air attacks and urging civilian populations to evacuate, the United States dropped two atomic bombs on two Japanese cities 3 days apart. Finally, Japanese leadership became convinced that the war was unwinnable, and on August 14th, Japan's Emperor Hirohito announced that Japan would surrender. Today, the guns are silent. General MacArthur, who accepted Japan's surrender on behalf of the Allies, said after the ceremony aboard the USS Missouri,
"A great tragedy has ended. A great victory has been won. The skies no longer rain death. The seas bear only commerce. Men everywhere walk upright in the sunlight. The entire world lies quietly at peace. The holy mission has been completed.
To the Pacific Basin has come the vista of a new emancipated world.
Today, freedom is on the offensive. Democracy is on the march. Today, in Asia as well as in Europe, unshackled peoples are tasting the full sweetness of liberty, the relief from fear.
On September 2, 1945, the Second World War had truly, finally ended, and a new era began.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals.